going to call the committee to order, and we're having fun here for members in the audience because our gavel has, our physical gavel is actually taking a walk. We're hoping it'll walk its way back into the committee room here, and that way we can be official. But in the meantime, we're going to get started. And today's agenda is actually pretty straightforward and simple. We're going to hear from the Department of Education and the governor's budget recommendations and for K-12 education, and in particular pay attention to the policy implications within that budget. There will be no doubt a policy bill that will be coming forward from the department shortly, and that'll give us a much more in-depth opportunity to walk through the department's policy requests and thinking. But I didn't want to wait for a couple of weeks to have that conversation. I just, you know, really wanted to get us warmed up thinking about the broad policy areas that are implied in the governor's budget. So my hope today is not just to have a straightforward presentation and we just sort of sit here and listen, but I really want some interaction here on a rolling basis. So heads up to the department presenters. So I'm encouraging you at any point in time to get my attention and weigh in, and let's just have a real good conversation about these broad policy parameters. So with that, I'm going to ask department staff to come forward. Do we have a quorum yet? Representative Isaacson, I'm wondering if you would move the minutes from our last meeting. They'll need to be amended because we don't have the date on the minutes, so we'll...
So well, it'll be my pleasure.
Thank you. So Representative Isaacson moves the minutes of the January 2nd or January 22nd meeting and amends the minutes to add the date onto the minutes of January 22nd. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. All right. We have a gavel. Good morning.
Good morning,
Assistant
Mr.
Commissioner
Chair.
Hermanson.
Members of the committee, my name is Rose Hermanson. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. Part of my role has been dealing with a substantial number of issues where we had working groups and task forces, which will, I'm assuming, many of them will become issues before this committee, and we'll be back and discuss them in more detail. What I'm here to do today, though, is to give a brief overview. I'll keep my comments short on the governor's budget, and then turn this over to Tom Melcher, who will go into more detail. But there are policy implications in some of the changes that are monetary in nature as we seek to implement them. First, I'd like to say on behalf of the commissioner, thank you for having us. Last week, the governor laid out a forward-thinking vision for Minnesota. One that is fair and balanced, and one that ensures that Minnesota is on a strong foundation and is moving forward. A big part of that strong foundation is education. It has put children first. It focuses on getting every Minnesotan a job. And it's one that seeks to deliver our government to the people in Minnesota in a more efficient and better way. Investing in our children is about all of us and our future. It is not only the morally right thing to do, but it is our personal and collective responsibility, and it's our best economic interest. This budget we see will reflect the needs to get our children off to a good start. It reflects our need to help those children who are new to our country and are learning our language. It puts services, we're looking at how we deliver our services, especially in the area of special education, and more fully funding that. We want our children to achieve their highest potential. They will grow, and they are our future, so we must do this. In this budget, we seek to support teachers and help them build their toolkit and share what works with each other. The governor said it, this is the first but not the last word, and we're always looking for new and good ideas. So we hope that as this budget and the policies around it go forward, you help us improve it. And finally, in the budget, you'll see that smarter investments are based on results and student needs. So we can ensure that every student and teacher has what they want to be successful. We want to have every child ready for kindergarten. We want every child reading well at third grade. And we want every child finishing the, crossing the finish line ready to go out and pursue their higher education or a job. We want them to have a future here in Minnesota. Very briefly, as they're getting the PowerPoint put together, the governor has invested about $344 million in new revenue for schools. And this is broken down in several categories. There's $52 or $118 million of new funding that's on the formula. $125 million is being added to special education. And for those of you familiar with schools, we have a huge cross-subsidy in education. In reality, what this does is free up dollars on the in the general ed budget for other uses in the school system by us meeting our obligations. Along with that special ed funding, there is going to be suggested changes in how we distribute or a formula for distribution of the dollars, and Tom will talk more about that. We want our kids getting off to a good early start, and so the budget proposes $44 million in early childhood education scholarships. These are for our younger learners, our 3- and 4-year-olds. The governor has added $40 million to enhance all-day, everyday kindergarten. Although this does not get us to every student, it makes progress in reaching that goal. We have $10 million for teacher evaluation. This will probably be a significant policy issue before this committee. This is just the beginning of the implementation. As you may be well aware, we must have teacher evaluation ready for full implementation by the 14-15 school year. And so we will be out piloting. The committee has just finished working on putting together a state model, and we will begin the process of piloting that in the second year of this biennium. And our goal here is to help us do those pilots right and help us get off to a good start on that program. There's $8.9 million for English language learners. Basically, this allows us from going from 5 to 7 years to help those who are new to our country and learning our language to get a better start and accomplish that. We have $4.5 million for regional centers of excellence. Primarily, this is to, right now we've established 3. They're being funded through federal dollars. This would add 6 more. And this is to get the services and the help from the department out into all areas of the state and make it more readily accessible to every school district in the state. We're going to also have an initiative to reduce paperwork as it relates to special ed and make it more streamlined, efficient. And then finally, there's $1 million in the budget, in the education budget, to establish a school climate center to help with the prevention of bullying and establish a better school climate in our schools. When we go through the slideshow, I will also cite a couple other areas where there's funding for kids that are not necessarily in the education budget but are in other budgets, but we will be working cross-agency. One of the goals of this governor is to have more cross-agency collaboration around the needs of our kids and implement some programs that can do so. We now have... I think maybe I've covered some of that already. I've kind of covered the first slides. I wasn't sure if they had it set up. I think the third slide shows the bottom line, and I'm going to let Tom start with that.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the finance director at the Department of Education. This slide shows the bottom lines on the governor's education budget. He is proposing a $344 million increase for the biennium. That is a 1% increase in the first year of the biennium and a 3.5% increase over current law in the second year of the biennium. As far as the tails go, in fiscal year 16 and 17, There is an ongoing amount added to the base here of about 4%, $647 million over the biennium, and there is also $1.2 billion that would go to repaying both the aid payment shift and the property tax shift, so that by the end of the 2016-2017 school year, we would be at 90% on state aids, which is our traditional number, and we would also have fully paid off the property tax shift. The breakdown of the investments by category include $118 million on the formula. That's a 1% increase over current law. $40 million for optional all-day K. This is not fully funding all-day K, but it partially funds all-day K for all districts. $125 million in special education. $44 million for early learning scholarships. $10 million for teacher growth evaluation, and $8.9 million for English language learners. In the general education area, the governor's proposal would increase the basic formula by $52 to $5,276, a 1% increase in the first year of the biennium. It would also, in 2014, extend funding for English language learners from 5 years to 7 years, and it would clarify kindergarten early entrance requirements for students under 5 years of age. That last piece is a modest budget savings by essentially requiring more complete district policies when students are admitted to kindergarten before 5 years of age. 2015, the governor is recommending that the funding in the general education program be maintained at the fiscal 14 level, which is 1% over current law, and that we have a simplified general education funding formula, which would include simpler pupil weights, including a 0.55 weight for kindergarten for those districts that do not opt to have all-day kindergarten, 1.0 for grades 1 through 6, 1.2 for grades 7 through 12. We would eliminate marginal cost pupil units, establish a simpler, more straightforward way of allocating money for declining enrollment school districts, which would be roughly the same dollars as currently, but through a simpler formula. We would eliminate the aid reduction for pension contributions. Currently, we make a subtraction from the state aid that is paid to school districts based on the amount of money they saved in 1997 as a result of a change in the employer contribution rate. A lot has changed since 1997. We don't think it's equitable to continue to base state aid on what was happening that long ago. So we would kind of make that adjustment into the formula. The governor is also recommending rolling gifted and talented revenue, $12 per pupil unit, into the basic formula to provide more discretion for local school boards in the use of their revenue. The formula allowance for 2015 would be set at $5,700. That is equivalent to the $5,276 the governor is recommending in 2014. And this slide shows the math. Essentially, what we do is currently the formula allowance would be $5,276. We net out the impact of the pension adjustment and the separate funding of gifted and talented. We adjust for the change in pupil unit weightings and the separate decline revenue, and so $5,700 is the same bottom line as the $5,276. It's just a simpler and more straightforward calculation. So under this proposal, when the formula allowance is $5,700, that's the actual funding that would be going out to school districts in grades 1 through 6. Right now, we've got $5,224. Districts actually get something like $5,700, but it takes a mathematician to get through all of the calculations to show how much money we're really giving. So this is a more straightforward, transparent way of showing how much money we have for schools. The governor's also recommending that operating referendum revenues be calculated using adjusted pupil units instead of the old resident marginal cost pupil units. In other words, your rate for a referendum would be based on how much money you're asking for per student that you're actually serving, rather than making a calculation based on the number of residents in your district and then having money transfer back and forth. So again, it's a little more simple and straightforward. The bottom line is that there's no change in the revenue that school districts receive. There's no change in their state aid. It's just a simpler way of doing the calculations. In the area of equity revenue, we have a very complex, cumbersome funding formula right now. The proposal would be to simplify the formula and target the money more fairly to school districts with low referendum revenue per student. So under the proposed formula, there would be a sliding scale equal to $100 times the district times the greater of zero, or 2,000 minus the district's referendum. So in other words, if a district had no referendum revenue, they would get $100 per pupil unit in equity. If they had a $2,000 referendum, they would not receive that money, and in between it's a sliding scale. So if you had a $1,000 referendum, you get $50. Simple, straightforward formula. It would not exclude districts that do not have a referendum, which the current formula does. It would not exclude Minneapolis and St. Paul, which the current formula does. One uniform formula would apply to all school districts in the state. In addition to the sliding scale, there would also be a $56 per pupil unit allocation, which is similar to the current formula, which has a $46 per pupil allocation. In the area of basic skills funding, the governor is recommending that the funding be reallocated based on student needs to provide greater flexibility to school districts in closing achievement gap. And this includes two major changes. One of them would be rolling extended time revenue into the compensatory revenue formula, so school districts would be receiving additional funding based on poverty concentration instead of receiving funding based on additional hours that students spend in school before school, after school, during the summer. In addition, the governor is recommending that there be additional local flexibility in the use of compensatory revenue. Currently, school districts are required to spend 95% of their compensatory revenue at the building that generated the revenue based on poverty counts. This would require 85% of the money to be spent at that building and provide school districts with flexibility on the other 15%. We found that quite often there isn't a one-to-one correspondence between the poverty concentration and the need for additional funds for students that need extra help. This would provide districts the ability to target that with 15% of the money to those schools that have the greatest issues in terms of achievement gaps.
And Mr. Melcher, I'm going to slow you down at this point. And members, so from here on out, the slides are, I think, if I remember right, because it's the same presentation we had in Chair Marquardt's committee. And I, we have so many members of this committee who don't serve on the Finance Committee. So first and foremost, I wanted to make sure that our Policy Committee members, you know, had the same opportunity to look at the broad outline of the budget recommendations as the Finance Committee. But from here on out, you know, we'll get very specific about you know, particular programs and categoricals. And so I really want to encourage committee members to start weighing in here and asking questions. I'm looking at Representative Bly because I kind of suspect there'll be a couple of questions. And let me just also say that we don't have all the experts from the department and all the people who have the portfolios of all of these various categories and programs before us. We will circle back when we have the big policy bill, excuse me, to have deeper conversations in these areas. And so I'm kind of letting you guys off the hook a little bit, but to the degree that you're able to provide some insight back to committee members on any one of these areas in terms of, you know, what the thinking was in terms of these adjustments, what's the philosophy that kind of drives that. And then also to the degree that you can take notes as you hear members, perhaps concerns and advice, that would be a good way for us to spend our time together. So now that I've given my committee members permission to ask questions, I suspect we're going to have several questions at this point. So, Commissioner
Mr. Chair and members, just a couple of broad things. Many of these recommendations came from a task force we had pulled together on education funding. And the commissioner had given them some kind of broad direction. And I'm going to cite a few of those right now, which may put this in context. The commissioner wanted our formulas to be more understandable, clear, and cleaner. In other words, not all the complexity. Simplicity was one of them. How can we simplify these formulas to make them more understandable generally instead of everybody having to go talk to Dr. Melcher and figure out how they work. Number two, one of the other things was, can we make the decision maker, can we push the decision making around use of dollars closer to the delivery? In other words, more local control, more focus on what people know works in their areas. Can we make these formulas a little more nimble, because we constantly get requests for things that maybe or maybe not fit under a category, and we kind of make decisions, but we feel that as we are changing, this world is changing very rapidly in how we deliver educational, can we give free up districts to make more decisions based on what they see are their needs, and that's some of the logic behind some of the simplification and some of the changes you will see. I know there are certain programs in here that have had constituents and supporters, and then we had to ask ourselves, the working group had to ask themselves, are we the appropriate ones to be making decisions at the state level, putting all these monies into pots, and not maybe letting local boards and others make the decisions that would be appropriate for their area? So that was some of the thinking behind some of these changes that you're going to be hearing about today.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I, right off the bat, I think that I suspect that some of the things we'll be struggling with in regards to that direction is our sense of responsibility to make sure that we're supporting a policy frame instead of a policy frame that that provides equal access, equal opportunity across the state. I mean, these are always the struggles of legislatures. You know, how do we not just do what's best for my particular part of the state, but how do we make sure that we have policies that, to the extent they can be uniform as possible, are guided by this notion of providing good, strong, high-quality, equal opportunity and access. So with that, I'm going to open up Representative Bly and Representative Villaruso. And Representative Bly, you're probably going to want to use the microphone.
Yes.
Because otherwise we may not be able to record your thoughts here.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you for the reminder. I wanted to ask about the rolling the extended time revenue into the general fund. As a little background on myself, I spent a good deal of my pre-legislative time in alternative programs and worked a lot with that. And one of the concerns I have about doing that is that a hard-fought principle over the years was to make sure that the dollars followed the student, and to make sure that students who were at risk for not graduating did get the necessary funds they needed to be successful, and that those programs and teachers got that kind of revenue. This would essentially end that, and so I'm concerned about that. And then I have some more I wanted to ask about that too. But.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Blythe.
Mr. Melcher.
We do have a provision in law which requires that school districts allocate 90% of the money that's generated by students attending an area learning center to that program, and that does not change in this recommendation. So there would still be allocations going from school districts to area learning centers, money following students that are attending alternative programs. I think what's different about this one is kind of the front end on how you generate the money to begin with. And so what this is saying, there would be more money allocated based on poverty counts in districts, and we would not be saying if you provide extended hours, we will give you more money. If you do not provide extended hours, we will not give you more money. And I think the theory behind that is to provide greater flexibility for school districts in deciding how do we address achievement gaps and what is the most successful strategy in our local community. Do we believe that we will have greater success in closing achievement gaps by providing more intensive services to these students during the school day, or do we think that we're going to be better off if we provide extra services before school, after school, and in the summer? And so the idea here would be to provide more local discretion in terms of how they use those dollars, not to reduce the resources that are available for that purpose, but still, ultimately, students still have a right to attend an alternative program, an area learning center, and if they do, we still have the requirement in law that 90% of the money must follow the student.
Representative Blunt.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Mariani. I understand that, and I think part of the issue is that over the years we've also learned that having those other options for students, summertime, after school, especially in the high school age group, is really helpful because these are students that are likely to be more successful with more options. And also some of the for younger students to have some of those extra times available also makes it more successful. And I understand that you're saying that the school boards and the local administration would have more leeway about how to decide it, but that's exactly the reason why we've gone down this road to try to protect those funds and those programs, because the administrators, the school boards that make these decisions don't always have the same kind of concerns about these particular students. They have other concerns that they feel are more important sometimes, and it's sometimes difficult to make sure that those dollars and those programs are able to provide what's needed for those students. So it really causes me great concern that we're going to be moving backwards as far as those programs are concerned. In 2010, the legislative auditor did a study of alternative programs, and I think they showed that they're quite effective in what they do. And I hate to see us move backwards on this, and that's what I fear the result of this will be. We'll find that those programs are less able to meet the needs of students at risk, and even though local boards and administrators have the choice to do something, they may not, and so that you're removing protections for those students.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner.
Representative Bly, I think this allows us to have a good, thorough discussion. We're proposing a change. We had this discussion in the working group. There's good information, and I don't think we've been looked at the picture as a whole. I know, and you were here before, you did have a subcommittee on this. There will be policy implications around this decision, and I think it's good for us to lay this out now, have these discussions, and we'll come back to you and this committee with more information and the people who are working with these programs, so we can take a fresh look at this and see if, and use the legislative audit report, because they did target in on some programs that were very effective and others that maybe were not working as well, and look at it in a new context. What are the contexts of delivery now, and have districts weigh in too as to their commitment. I think overall the commissioner has a very strong focus in this budget, as does the governor, in closing that achievement gap. And our goal would be to have fewer and fewer kids who probably need the credit recovery in these programs, and so I think this will be a very healthy and welcome discussion for this committee to have about how it's best to do that.
Thank you, Commissioner, and that is a good reminder, excuse me, a good echoing of how I hope to frame our conversation today, which is we're not going to resolve these things today. We want to get out in the open what the rationale supporting the proposals here, the recommendations of the governor, as well as to hear from members, what their concerns or support might be in that regard. Representative Yaruso, then Representative Verdal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could go back to the previous slide, there's an error in the formula that you stated in A. I believe that needs to be divided by $2,000. Otherwise, if you have no referendum, you're going to give $200,000 per pupil unit. Just want to make sure it got clear in the record here.
I think they've been found out.
Put Simon Pedro.
Yeah, the parentheses needs to be divided by $2,000.
Okay,
the result.
Thank you very much. Yep.
As the governor said, that we're going to have lots of ways of improving our budget.
We're building as we're going. Representative Erdahl and Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think Mr. Melcher, I'm just looking for a little historical perspective in light of the new budget. And what was in the last biennium? This was $344 million we're increasing this year. What was last biennium?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, I don't have the exact figure with me, but I believe it was in like the $150 million kind of range. Last biennium we had 1% on the formula the first year, $50, another 1% the second year, and then we also added the new literacy aid component, which was kind of like another 1%. So I would say that this is significantly more than the last biennium, but not double what the last biennium was. But I don't have the exact numbers, I'm sorry, with me.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Melcher, so the last biennium represented a larger formula increase, but not in these other areas.
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, that's correct. So last year we had a 1% increase on the formula the first year, another 1% the second year. And this year it's kind of the same, 1% on the formula the first year, but then in the second year there is a substantial investment in special education, which is roughly equal to another 3% of the formula. It's more dollars, but it's targeted toward closing cross subsidies in special education. So there, you end up with more variation in how much revenue per student each district would receive, depending on how big the cross subsidy is in that district, how much they're having to take out of the general fund to cover their unmet special ed costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
Now the shift has continued in this budget. Again, historical perspective. Do you have, off the top of your head, how many shifts have been done in state history?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl.
And by the way, let me. I'm sorry. Just and absolutely all questions are fair game here. I do want us to focus on the policy ramifications of the bill. Obviously, it's hard to disentangle any of the finance from policy. But I'm hoping that as we continue our conversation, we're getting trying to stay as centered as possible on what impact the programs and broad policy directives are happening as a result of the budget. I don't want to totally allow, quote-unquote, Representative Marquardt's committee to be the only one that weighs in on the finance, but we do have a finance committee that will be weighing heavily on the pure, money, dollars issues. Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, we have always had a 90-10 payment structure in the state going back to the early 70s, and in the early 80s, we did an aid payment shift when we had a budget problem in 1983-84, and we were paying 85% rather than 90%, and we did that until the mid-90s. We paid back the shift in the mid-90s. Then we had another budget problem in 2003, and we shifted in 2003 down to about 80-20 as far as payments go, and we repaid that in 2006, and then we shifted again in 2010. So those were the kind of the three periods that we have used the shift in the past, and we've always had a policy in place to repay those shifts, and sometimes it takes longer than other times.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just finishing up, so this is an established policy that has been used several times in the past, and you would not call it a gimmick.
Mr. Melcher, we've heard this gimmick word
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Erdahl, I have been around here since 79, long time, and what we do or don't call gimmicks is probably all in the eye of the beholder, because as we've changed pupil weightings and we've changed other parts of the formulas, it all has financial implications. We've also had tax recognition shifts. We've had delayed payments. We've had prorations. I mean, I've seen almost all things being used in order to balance budgets. And so what we do or don't call gimmicks, I think the clear thing the governor wants to do is to meet our obligations, find the revenues, and no longer kick cans down the road and have a plan for getting us on a stable foundation. So.
And most importantly, I would say that having a stable foundation, however we get there, whether it's through quote-unquote gimmick or some other mechanism, is vitally important for us to be able to promote the policies, to actually realize the policies that that we pursue on behalf of our kids in our statutory policy frame.
Let me just finish up by saying, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
that I agree with your comments, appreciate that, and glad that you're pointing out that the governor's plan to continue the shift is not a gimmick.
All right. Representative Briner, followed by Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of areas I'd like to ask questions in, and the first will come as no surprise. It's in the area of teacher growth and evaluation. And what I'd like to ask is a context for the recommendation in the governor's budget. First of all, I'd say you'd have a range of opinion among those who maybe haven't been involved in the process that why would you need any money to support this process, to others who might say we've only scratched the surface of the need. So I'd like a context for the recommendation and then maybe a comparison to resources available to QCOMP districts as opposed to those who aren't participating in QCOMP.
Mr. Chairman, the discussion of the teacher evaluation is a couple slides down. Perhaps I could do the...
But why don't we jump ahead there, and then we'll
there.
Come back
okay.
to Representative
so
Brenner's question,
slide 15.
And then we'll have other members' questions mm-hmm. still teed up.
Yep, and so the governor's recommendation on teacher growth and evaluation is to provide $22 per student enrolled on October 1st of the prior year to schools or districts that are not currently participating in QCOMP. Those resources would be available for support of teacher growth and evaluation systems, and Ms. Hermanson can provide a little background on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Briner, I'd like to personally thank you for being so involved with the teacher work group. For those of you new to the committee, we've had the legislation was passed, I think, in 2011 during special session, and we were directed at the department to develop what we call a default model, a model that must be used should the districts and teachers not come to agreement on a model. And there are criteria laid out in law, and I'm assuming this committee will more thoroughly go into that, as to what must be in that model. There are a significant number of items included in the statute that will need resources to find ways to implement. And I want to just cite a few right now, then I'll get back to the funding requirement. I have two staff right now working in Fergus Falls today, working with school districts on both the principal and the teacher models to help those districts understand what's required in statute and to work with them around how they might go about developing and implementing the requirements. In the case of principal evaluation, it requires an annual one, but the department does not implement a default model. We just put together a model to guide them. In the case of the teachers, it does require that we have a default model in place should they not reach agreement. The principal model goes into effect this fall, so we are piloting it now, I think, in about 15, 16 districts. The teacher model, we are in the process of adopting pilots. We will have a request going out probably within the next month for districts and teachers to agree to be a pilot. These are low stakes pilots because we want to see how the model works. But there are certain elements that are going to have to be put in place, and let me cite a few. The law requires for trained and qualified evaluators. How do we do that, and what does that mean? As we've looked at other states, there's a significant amount of resources putting into making sure we have appropriately trained and qualified people doing the evaluations. There's a requirement that we have 35% of the teacher's evaluation tied to a value-added model for areas where we can do that, but it also requires that 35% of the model be tied to student achievement. And so how do we do that in non-tested areas? What resources do districts, and this is the area that most districts have identified in the survey we did as the biggest area of need. How do we get to that 35% in a fair and reasonable way that is valid and reliable, especially when you're going from high school all the way down to kindergarten and have to do this for special education instructors as well. So there's such a wide variety of individual job classifications in teaching that we would have to figure out how to develop the 35%. A third major component in what is required is student engagement and connectedness. What does that look like? And if you listen to the research out of the Gates Foundation and the MET project, this is probably one of the most significant parts of the model. In fact, the kids will tell you how well a teacher's doing, and we have to find a way of doing that, which involves perhaps developing student surveys, and not just one survey. We have to talk about how to engage a kindergartner all the way through a high school student. So this is not a simple task, and how we do the student connectedness and engagement is very important, and that will be a portion. And in addition, so you have the three big pieces. Then it also requires for professional learning communities. It requires, we're doing the evaluations to identify staff needs for development. And so what are the costs for staff development? So this money that we have here is to begin the process and help us put staff in place and work with districts, but also to give those districts who don't get QCOMP money, which is roughly $260 per student, resources to help them find ways to develop these assessments for the 35%, train the evaluators, figure out how to implement the student engagement, which you administer the survey, but you have to interpret it, you have to validate it. And so there are significant cost factors in this area that we've looked at other states, and we're trying to come up with the best estimate as to, in the long term, what this may require, and this is just the beginning of that discussion.
Representative Brennan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hermanson, thanks for the context, and I won't challenge any of that. I think it does provide an understanding to the committee as a beginning point from which we'll have a much more robust conversation in the future. But I have a second policy area that I want to draw attention to, and others may bring it up in some context too, but it's the roll-in of the gifted and talented formula. And understanding the broad issues around local control and flexibility, many of us here have been on school boards ourselves and generally agree with that philosophy. Nevertheless, I think the roll-in of gifted and talented provides some issues to us as policymakers and to the state that aren't provided by all roll-ins. And that's, I think if indeed we end up rolling in that amount of the formula, we have to look at some outcome measures. I think we have to have some expectations that the state will keep an eye on achievement of that top 5 to 10% of our students, because what the formula has provided in the past is a tool for communities, really, in a certain sense, to hold school boards and districts' feet to the fire on this issue around the achievement level of these upper, high achievers. And it's easy in an environment that's focused on closing the achievement gap to lose our commitment to that at least 1 year's growth for that upper end. So with that comment in mind, I'd like you to comment on the risks of the roll-in for the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bryan, I'll answer, and then I'm going to let Kevin McHenry address it a little bit too. Although the commissioner is very committed to closing this achievement gap, she's also very committed to have all kids reach their full potential, as exhibited by the initiatives they're doing with the higher ed in relation to the 1114 directive. And we want to find ways to challenge these top students. And again, this is going to be, I think, a fairly rich policy discussion with this committee about how we best do that. This particular proposal in funding, again, is somewhat driven towards simplification, but as you see our policy bill, you may see some other initiatives that relate to gifted and talented that probably will dovetail with some of what's being proposed in the funding. And again, I would encourage us to have that discussion. School districts have clearly indicated with the range of things that they're offering kids, especially in the areas of foreign languages, some of the immersion schools, that there's more than one way of addressing the needs of our high-achieving kids, and I think we, again, need to have that full and rich discussion.
Mr. McHenry, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Briner, Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. I just wanted to piggyback on what Ms. Hermanson was referring to. One of the things that we were successful in was receiving a waiver from NCLB, and under that waiver, we do have a different accountability system that measures more than just one outcome. So what we're looking at is measuring overall proficiency, and we're focusing on achievement gap as well as the graduation rate. But one thing that we are focusing on as well is growth. And so as we have that specific measure to focus on, that'll give us another tool to help with the with all students, some that are needing to reach proficiency and some that are beyond proficiency as well.
And committee members, we might it might be helpful for us earlier, not later, to perhaps have a presentation from the department on the new accountability system that we're under a waiver from NCLB. We have quite a few new members here who were not here during that period of time. I think we did some, I think Chair Erickson might have had some conversations with this in the last couple of weeks as well. it's a very important context within which any drive towards simplification, you know, has to be able to operate well against. And so perhaps, Commissioner, we can talk about having department folks come in and do a walkthrough of the philosophy and the mechanics of the new accountability system.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do so.
And then I thought I heard maybe, and we don't need to get into it right now, but I thought maybe I heard from your last response, Representative Binder, that there might be some other gifted and talented or some other recommendations coming forward on gifted and talented students and services.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It'll probably be in our policy bill. I remember I worked on it a little bit the other day with some of our staff to get the language together. And so, it's maybe not totally significant, but it does dovetail with some other reference.
We don't need to get into those today, but I just want to make sure that we're flagging that for ourselves. Representative Dabney, I apologize. You had a point on point with the previous question regarding the teacher evaluation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No need to apologize. Just a quick question on the 22 per student on teacher evaluation. Can those monies also be used for developing and implementing the principal evaluation process, or is this limited to classroom teachers or others within the teacher bargaining unit, or however it's defined?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, as you look at the way it's put in the budget, the principal evaluation is going to be implemented the first year. And what we will be doing, we will be hopefully putting staff in place to facilitate that, which we currently have through a Bush grant. But the dollars are specifically targeted toward teacher evaluation. And our partners in the principal evaluation are the two principal. When the legislature directed us to develop this sample model, we partnered with the Elementary School Principals Association and the Secondary School Principals Association. And we have been working with that Bush grant to help them get going, work with districts and educating them about what is needed. We obviously could have used some resources, but we didn't. But this very specifically is targeted toward teacher evaluation.
Thank you, Ms. Hermanson. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Commissioner Hermanson, you've mentioned the Bush grant several times, and I just don't want that to sort of float over members' heads here. I mean, the bottom line is that right now we have a department that, my understanding is, we have a department that's carrying out part of its responsibilities and directives that have resulted from legislation. Much of it originated within the legislature itself. They're doing that with private dollars. And so one of the things I want members to think about, and we can have a good discussion about whether it's wise for us or not to be able to implement public policy dependent on the availability of private dollars to do so. Obviously, the aid here is meant to answer that question, or at least partly answer that question of the department's capacity. This begs sort of bigger questions about the capacity of the department relative to any directives that arise out of legislation. So I just want members to keep that in mind. We live in a wonderful state where we have great foundations and great corporations that are willing to step up and help both our local and state governments enhance and reform our education system. In my mind, it's different than trying to build a sustainable model based on that ongoing giving. And so as we go forward, you know, consistently go forward in terms of developing a good reform policy frame in our state, we also have to pay close attention to the resources needed to be able to implement that frame.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, part of the reason the Bush Foundation became involved with this was at our request. If you will recall, for those of you who were here, we passed this bill in July during shutdown. We were requested to have a report back to the legislature on principal evaluation by February 1st of the following year, so there really wasn't many options in there for us to get the work done. We greatly appreciate them coming forward and want to acknowledge that. And when we get into the discussion of teacher evaluation further, we also partnered with some other groups like CCSSO, New Leaders, the Joyce Foundation. We've been seeking partners with a variety of groups and foundations that are working on these issues, a great deal out of need, but also taking advantage of their expertise because they are also working with other states. So it's been a good partnership, and we just wanted to acknowledge and thank them. St. Paul Foundation is another one that we worked with.
Thank you. Yes,
Representative. Thank you, Chair Mariani. And Ms. Hermanson, any dollars considered for the Principals Academy, considering the fact that that was something that we created some years ago, put some money into, and has been a great asset to our principals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I don't think there's anything in our budget on that. Mr. McHenry may want to address that briefly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the Principals Academy is not funded through the budget here. The idea was brought forward to us about a month ago. We heard from former Commissioner Segrin, as well as some folks from the University of Minnesota. They were outlining some ways that they are trying to proceed and laid out ideas what they'd like to continue working with us and working with the legislature on the Principals Academy.
Thank you for the question, Representative Erickson. I think we share a common interest in the Principals Academy. It would be good to continue the conversation in regards to this this initiative and how it perhaps might dovetail with that. Representative Benson and Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I ask the question of either of the presenters today, I just wanted to take a step further with Representative Breinhardt's last question about gifted and talented and whether or not integrating those funds into a general fund for those districts leave them open to be neglected. You know, when you think of gifted and talented, it reminds me of my experiences with teaching advanced placement all those years. I never knew because my administrators were very careful in keeping that information from those of us in the classroom that there was to be a limit on the number of students or the number of sections a teacher would teach of advanced placement. They simply used those funds for other programs. And when you look at the situation we have with counselors, for example, the low numbers of counselors, school psychologists, nurses, and so, all those issues revolve around a lack of adequate funding, in my opinion. That has been the case for several years now, and here in the state. So my concern is similar, maybe more than Representative Breinhardt's here, that it is one thing to say that the commissioner and the Department of Education will monitor all these things. Is quite a different thing to see what's happening in those districts on the ground, because they do take those funds, and they have to, because they need to have teachers in those classrooms, the regular math, science, social studies, language arts, and others. And so they find ways and sources. And even though sometimes these funds are specifically targeted for a particular activity, they still take them. And I know they do, because it happened in my district. So, but my question, so I don't know if you want any comment on that, but maybe that's just a comment on my part here. May I just get to the quick question? It has to do with slide 12 under equity revenue being simplified and targeted more fairly. And my question is, does this proposal, does it, and if it does, how does it affect a district similar to those that I represent that do a lot of self-funding through operating referenda? Does that or would that affect their access to their own referenda, or are these funds over and above that? There's been a controversy, you know, about it. Maybe somewhere else in your presentation you'll hit that issue.
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Benson, the proposal for change in equity is to simplify the equity revenue formula. It is a revenue that's available, kind of additional revenue over and above what school districts raise from referendums. And the goal of equity revenue has always been to narrow spending gaps between high and low spending districts in the wake of the scheme right. lawsuit that we had about 20 years ago. And so this does nothing to limit the ability of school districts to pass referendums. We do have limits on referendums,
right.
which are separate and apart from equity revenue. So a school district that had a referendum of $2,000 per student, which would be up at the high end, I think many of your districts are in the $1,500, $1,600 range. They would receive just the $56 per student, which is pretty comparable to the $46 per student they currently receive. It's just a more straightforward sliding scale, rather than right now we have four separate formulas within equity that get very cumbersome, and there are some exclusions which seem inequitable. For example, if you currently have no referendum at all, you don't get any of the sliding scale money. If you pass a referendum for $1 per student, which many districts have done, actually, so that they could get $75 of equity revenue.
Yeah.
It just seems a little contorted. So we're just trying to basically take the current concept that we want to provide some help to those school districts that have difficulty competing in the referendum world, mm-hmm. provide a little extra benefit to them. We're not taking anything away from people at the high end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. And Mr. Foster, I know you want to follow up on this, but let me take a quick break here, because we have some important guests in the audience with us today. I'm told we have 11th and 12th grade students. I spotted y'all as you came in, and I got very curious, and so I'm glad that someone sent me a note here. These are 11th and 12th grade students, members from Lionsgate Academy, and they're participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Education Program. I'm wondering if the students could stand up and be recognized by committee members. It's good to have you here. You all having a good time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm honored to be here.
Wonderful. What time did you all get here? All right. How long are we going to have you here?
For another 5 minutes, and then I got to go take them to meet their senator.
Wonderful. Well, listen, welcome to your capital. It's good to have you here.
Yeah. It's good to be here.
Thank you, dear. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that there are four formulas currently in this. Is one of those the levy equalization formula, or is that something totally different than this?
Mr. Belcher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Faust, referendum levy equalization is something separate.
Okay.
That it provides a state share of the referendum yep. levy. This is a different formula. Thank you.
All right, very well. No more questions? Oh, we do. Representative Barrett, I'm sorry. Representative Christian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to take us out of the weeds for a minute just to look philosophically at funding in Minnesota and how maybe it compares between districts in Minnesota. You know, you have the base formula of, what, $5,200 per student, and then you have a lot of categoricals, which we've been kind of talking a lot about. They add up to a significant amount of money. If you were to look at the top three districts in our state as far as per pupil funding, what would they be? Who would they be, and what? How much do they get per student? And then also the bottom three or four as well. Who would they be, and then how much do they get per student?
And we could also have our staff prepare that kind of information for the committee as well. I'm a little fearful it might not be a simple answer to that. Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be helpful to have the staff do a run. I haven't looked at the exact numbers, but I will say that there are significant differences in funding per student across the state. They largely have to do with, number one, access to referendum levies. Those are more property tax money as opposed to state aid money. But also they have a lot to do with the characteristics of the district and the needs that students bring in the district. And so school districts that have high concentrations of poverty and high concentrations of English language learners tend to generate more money than students that do not have those kinds of characteristics. So if I were to identify some of the highest funded school districts in the state, they would include some of our Indian reservation districts, such as Red Lake and Net Lake, where the poverty rate is well over 80%. And also there are school districts that have high concentrations of special education students. So I would also say that the inner city districts are relatively high as a result of a combination of high concentrations of poverty and high concentrations of special education students. And the funding levels in some of those districts can be, I want to say, roughly twice as high as a school district that had very low concentrations of special education students and very little poverty. But I don't have the numbers with me. I wouldn't want to quote the exact ones, but I'm sure House research staff can provide that.
Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I've been looking at that pretty hard lately because my districts are one of the lowest funded in the state. On the high end, districts get around $14,000 per child, and on the low end, about $8,000. So that's a pretty significant gap, 75% increase in funding. Maybe a philosophical question for you. Of that gap, let's say it's $6,000 per kid, just for sake of argument. How much of that $6,000 or whatever amount actually relates to a particular cost incurred by that high-funded school district? For example, sparsity probably relates to school buses and the fact you need more gas to drive roads. And how much has anyone done actually a study that shows whether that money actually is used to recover costs or that money is used to actually implement policy in which one district might have an opportunity to implement that policy, whereas my districts do not?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we do have breakdowns of data that identify, for example, how much some districts spend for transportation versus other districts. We know that some districts have much higher special education costs than other districts, and those are pretty much mandated and under federal and state law, and also the IEPs drive some of those costs. So you can pull out and break down a school district's budget, and in fact, we do that annually in our profiles report that we publish on the web that shows what our school districts spending for special education, for transportation, separate and apart from the general education program. So you can see what the differentials are in terms of some of the specific cost areas versus the general fund. It gets to be difficult breaking it down within the general fund, and we don't necessarily have good data on, you know, for example, all-day kindergarten versus not all-day kindergarten. Some districts provide it, some districts don't, but the numbers are all buried in the total cost of the general education program. So certainly more information would be helpful to analyze that question. It's an important question. We do have some data, but it's probably not as complete as you might like.
And Representative Marquardt, of course, you know, in your committee, we look at much of that data, and perhaps one of the things we can do collaboratively is to work with your committee to get the you know, the timely information to committee members here who are not who don't have the opportunity to serve on the finance committee. Representative,
sure. One final question related to that. It just seems to me that as we talk about changing a $30 levy to $32, or talk about adding $52 to the formula, not $50, we're pretty precise in what we want to increase. I think we might be losing the forest for the trees in the sense that I represent North Branch. We're on a 4-day school week, not because we want to be, but because we don't have the money for a 5-day week. I mean, that's a pretty obvious representation that North Branch doesn't have the money it needs to educate its kids, and they're on the bottom end of the district. I don't see any of that in the changes to Governor Dayton's budget. I don't see that obvious statement that 4-day school weeks need more to educate their kids, but yet that gap continues to be there. I don't understand that. Maybe you could help me understand that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I would say in the case of the North Branch School District, they are one of 10% of school districts that do not have an operating referendum levy. And school districts across the state have relied much more heavily on operating referendum levies over the past decade. 10 years ago, the average referendum levy was $350 per student. Now it's over $1,000 per student. What do school districts do with that extra $1,000 that they raise with their referendum levy? Well, some of those school districts are using that to pay for that fifth day of education. The governor's budget does, in a small way, assist the district like North Branch by making the equity revenue available to them. It gives them some additional dollars available if the local school board chooses to make an equalized property tax levy. But we're talking probably $50 per student or something in that order of magnitude. But the big difference between North Branch and many other districts is that they do not have a referendum levy, and that has provided a real pinch on the district's budget.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, we did have a representative from North Branch on our funding task force, and I think it was we often cite it North Branch because, you know, because of their the dollars were not there as compared to other districts, and some of the discussion was how do we try to work with those districts. And I know I think in North Branch they've tried to run referendums many times and they have not passed. And so there's a small recognition of that in the equity revenue. I don't think we're totally satisfied with, you know, how we address some of those issues, but we're trying to make a step in that direction. And some of it is there are districts who have made the commitment. We've relied a great deal more on property taxes. And as we did our working group, we could see that not only locally where we were passing referendums, as we laid out the dollars, even at the state legislature, we went from $200 million in local levies to over $700 million to fund other programming things because the dollars were not raised through aid. They were put on property tax. And I think the governor as a whole is very concerned about an over-reliance on property tax, but we still do have a state budget problem, and how we get to more adequately funding education, we do have to deal with our overall budget problem.
Just one final point.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you. With all due respect, it's not just the levy. You look at Chisago Lakes, they're at $8,500 per student. North Branch is at $8,000. Talking a $500 difference. Chisago has the levy. So we still have a large gap. Even though one has one doesn't. So I think the problem is more inherent in just a voter-approved levy locally. Obviously, it has to do with what money they get from that voter-approved levy. It's not fair across the state. Orono and those folks can get a lot of money for very little distribution from taxpayers. We can't. So it's really, to me, it's a fairly simple problem, but we still never seem to tackle it. And I'd appreciate, I think, if the department could look at that and help us so that we have adequate money for our kids in North Branch and Chisago.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, I'm sure Representative Marquardt will help us try to look at that problem as well.
Thank you.
We have a couple of other members, Roger Erickson and Representative Crisho, but what I want to do very quickly is to get through the department's sharing some information about the early childhood all-day K special ed funding and integration revenue and literacy aid, which are the next several slides. So if we can just go through those, and then I'll cycle back, and we'll start with Representative Crisho and then Representative Erickson.
Let me just say just very briefly that the governor's recommending that the charter schools receive access to the $32 per pupil Safe Schools revenue. Currently, all school districts receive the Safe Schools revenue through a levy. In the governor's recommendation, this would provide $32 for charter schools. So it creates a little more equity across the state in terms of all schools having access to funds for Safe Schools. There are some technical kinds of changes I'll skip over here. I'll get to the all-day kindergarten proposal. The governor is recommending that the pupil unit weighting for kindergarten be increased from 0.55 to 0.7 for students who are enrolled in a free all-day everyday kindergarten program available to all students at the student school. So this is a site-based proposal. The governor is recommending that kindergarten programming be optional as to whether it's all day or full or part-time. Also that be optional by the district at the site level. So if a school district decides to provide free all-day everyday kindergarten programming at a particular site, the students at that site will generate another $908 per student on the average for the district. So it's not full funding of kindergarten, but it does provide strong incentive for school districts to provide free all-day everyday kindergarten by providing them with another $908 per student. Currently, 54% of the students in the state are in a free all-day everyday kindergarten program. That number grew by 5% last year, up from 49%. Over the last 6 years, we've seen about a 3% increase each year. So we're seeing more and more students going into all-day everyday kindergarten. We think with a $908 per student incentive, we could speed up that growth and make that available to most students within a relatively short period of time. In the special education area, the governor is recommending $125 million increase. That would reduce the average cross-subsidy per student by $180. So in the typical school district, this is not going to have a dramatic effect on special education programming because school districts are mandated to provide special education services. What happens is when they do provide required special ed services, they have to take the money out of the general fund to cover the unfunded cost. On the average right now, that's $645 for every student in the district. This would go down to $465. So it's kind of indirectly a way of increasing the general education funding for schools, but it does it in a way that's targeted to needs so that those schools that have higher special education needs are receiving more of that increase to reduce their unfunded cost. There's also a major policy change here, and that would be that the serving school district or charter school would be required to pick up 10% of the unfunded cost of providing special education. Currently, we require the resident district to pick up 100% of the unfunded cost, and that creates some incentive issues for the non-resident serving district where basically special education is free and they know that somebody else is going to pay the tab. So this creates a little bit of an incentive for efficiency in the provision of services without making it so large that it's going to create a deterrent to allowing students to open and enroll. In the area of integration revenue, as you know, the formula sunsets this June if we don't have a new formula put in law. The governor looked at the work of the Integration Task Force and the work of the School Finance Task Force and is proposing for 2014 that we have a new formula that, first of all, would guarantee all districts that they would get at least 90% of the funding they got in 2013 from integration revenue, but then would establish a new formula that would be based on the percentage of students of color in the district. So it would be more of a sliding scale. Right now, we treat school districts with a 15% minority concentration the same as a suburban school district with a 70% minority concentration. We think there should be a little bit more gradual variation there as the characteristics differ. Also, the governor's proposing that we have a performance-based measure as part of this by including the focus rating, which is a measure, part of the MMR that measures the success the district is having in closing the achievement gap. So the two big changes for 2014 are to make the formula more sensitive to differences among districts in concentration of students of color, and to add a relatively small portion that is tied to closing the achievement gap while maintaining a floor for all districts that they won't see a huge drop in their revenue compared to 2013. Now, when we get to 2015, we have an issue because the levy for integration has sunset. Under the 2011 legislation, there was a one-year extension of the integration levy for pay 2013. I think that was adopted with the expectation that the 2012 legislature would take action and continue that levy, but because there was no change in 2012, the integration levy has sunset, so in our current law tracking, we show no integration levy. To continue that levy in fiscal 15 would be a levy increase compared to how we're tracking current law. So the governor is recommending that the integration aid formula that he proposes for 14 be continued in 15, but because the levy is sunset under current law, the school districts would see a 30% reduction in their total integration funding in fiscal year 15. With respect to literacy incentive aid, the governor is recommending that we take the existing dollars that we have in the program, roughly $54 million, and do a more balanced approach where we look not only at reading at the third grade, but also high school graduation rate. Currently, half of the money is allocated based on proficiency in third grade reading. Half of it is allocated based on growth between third grade and fourth grade. The governor's proposal would say that we want to spend two-thirds of the literacy aid, allocate that based on growth in reading between third and fourth grade, and the other 30% of the literacy aid dollars would be based on high school graduation rate in the district compared to what the high school graduation rate would be in that district if we take into account the demographics of the district and what the state average graduation rates are for students in that demographic group. So there's another significant switch here of allocating literacy aid 30% on high school graduation and 70% based on third grade reading rather than 100% based on third grade reading. And the bottom lines in the formula essentially are to provide a 3% increase in funding overall, and the proposal is balanced between the inner city, the inner ring suburbs, outer ring suburbs, and small, medium, and large rural districts and charter schools. They're all getting in the neighborhood of a 3 to 3.5% increase. This is on averages across these groups. You do see significantly larger variations within those groups depending on the unique demographic characteristics and special education populations and so forth. And on property taxes, the governor is essentially at a zero target on property taxes. The budget does have a $4.8 million net reduction in property taxes. Oh, sorry.
Part of the overall budget, what you'll see is a link to performance measures and outcomes. One of the areas that we've seen some of the best returns on investment is investments in early childhood education. In the previous biennium, there was $3 million appropriated per year for early childhood scholarships. This is expanding on that current program, increasing it by $22 million a year. We're expecting to see about 10,000 early childhood scholarships that will be linked to high-quality providers. Also, part of this proposal, we want to make sure that this is a successful through the private entrepreneurs, but also in the public schools, similar to the higher education system. One other aspect that's included, regional centers of excellence. I touched on the NCLB waiver. Out of the NCLB waiver, the federal funds right now, we have three regional centers of excellence that specifically work with our priority and focus schools. Priority and focus schools are our lower performing schools and the schools that are contributing the most to the achievement gap. This proposal would expand the number of regional centers of excellence from 3 to 8. So the goal of it would be to go beyond just priority and focus schools. The idea behind this is that we want to be able to, in different areas of the state, share evidence-based best practices. So districts, so let's say we're in the northwest region of the state, it might be better for them to all come together, share their ideas, rather than getting everything here from St. Paul. So we're hoping that that's going to be a mechanism to work in conjunction with what's already out there, but also work on expanding our evidence-based best practices, and also helping along with the teacher and principal evaluation.
As I mentioned earlier, one of the recommendations that came out of the task force on bullying, this is a direct result of that recommendation. I think as a policy, you may be looking at the broader recommendations, but specifically in the governor's budget, there's a recommendation that we establish a school climate center at the Department of Ed, and primarily the school climate center is to work to establish standards for preventions and interventions, that we go out and work with districts in this serious issue of bullying that has kind of risen to the surface over the last years, and how we deal with it within school districts. The Climate Center would be working with a cross-agency advisory committee. One of the other proposals, which is on one of the later slides, also establishes a school safety center. These will be working in tandem also to deal with issues in the school around school safety and school climate. The Climate Center would be established at the department. It's $500,000 per year. And I think the School Safety Center, which is on the next slide, also is slightly more than $1 million over the biennium, so roughly $500 million per year. That will be coming through the Department of Public Safety.
And then we have just some final other cross-agency initiatives.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. There's some grants for mental health will come through the Department of Health, and also the Access to Quality Department of Human Services. We're working on Access to Quality Early Child Care initiatives. And then finally, in housing finance, there's a provision of dealing with our highly mobile students. How do we keep these students more tied to their schools? Is there ways of doing that through housing support and initiatives? And so those are some of the other cross-agency. We have alarmingly more and more kids who are homeless. And very transient. It's very difficult to monitor and work with those kids and make sure they're getting an appropriate education and can be improving their lot in life, so they don't have to deal with some of the very stressful issues they're dealing with now.
Thank you. Members, we have about 5 minutes left. We have a couple of questions. Obviously, we're not going to cover everything here. Well, we will obviously get much deeper bites of this apple as the policy bill comes forward from the department, and we'll be shaping that together. I would encourage members to contact me in terms of any of the to let me know of any of these areas that you're particularly interested in working on, or if you have ideas about and ways that perhaps I can help you as individual members to be able to forward those ideas and fold it into the policy bill deliberations. I will be sending out a sort of survey to committee members, asking them to check off areas of interest that align with any of the governor's policy initiatives here. So look for that. So we have Representative Crescia, Representative Roger Erickson, and then Representative Erdahl. Let's see how we do. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I'll make this quick. And I guess, as I look, thank you for all the work you guys have done, by the way. This is, I know how complicated, and I understand the budget situation that we're in. And I appreciate your patience in addressing one more question about outstate, because in my district, in the Little Falls, Harry Morrison and Todd, this is a very, very big issue. One of the question that I have is, as a general tax environment and as a whole, we're going to be pushed a couple districts back into the levy competition. We'll be trying to pass them in the fall because this didn't fix what they were hoping, or it didn't address the needs they had. But the concern I have now, and I'm just wondering if you have past data as a general tax environment. With the broadening of the sales tax and some of the other perceptions, will this, in your opinion, do you think make it harder or easier or no difference for districts that are in the outstate to pass some of these levy referendums? I mean, tax environment and perception can be a very difficult thing for us. And being that this is the only question they'll get to answer yes or no on, I'm just wondering if there's any data that suggests when there's other broader taxes, people contract a bit. And my real concern is this going to drive a larger wedge for us trying to compete, because this is our biggest way of being competitive?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a tough question to answer, because while we were doing our trips around the state talking about school funding, I know Commissioner Franz was going around the state talking about tax environment, and we did have members from his staff observing while we were talking through our issues. It depends on whether rates are reduced. You know, I know the sales tax discussion is broadening it and then reducing rates. How that plays out in individual areas, I guess I really don't know. One of the things we did find, though, in our trips around the state, and especially in rural areas, it was a surprise to me, more so, was that many of these districts felt that in order to be competitive, they had to offer certain programmings, or kids were opening and enrolling to a neighboring district. The one area in particular was all-day K. I remember specifically a couple superintendents saying, we have to offer and pay for all-day K, because if we don't, our neighboring districts will, and then the parents will take their kids to those districts. So they've felt that our initiatives on more fully funding all-day K would help reduce some of the pressure on their budgets, because they're now funding that program through general fund dollars. So you'll see several things in this budget, special ed being another one, all-day K being one, surprisingly, in rural areas, that will reduce the pressure on their budget by helping to fund something they're funding through the general fund dollars. Now, how referendums will fare, I guess I can't really predict. I think the governor has made a commitment. He does not want property taxes increasing, and so if we hold the line on property tax increases, I think it'll be up to local taxpayers to decide how much additional help they want to present schools, and the schools lay out their needs. One of the big increasing areas is technology. How do we stay current on technology with kids, because they want their kids to have the advantages that they see other districts have as they go out into the world or go on to higher ed, and how can they be competitive? And so we're trying to keep all of that in mind.
Representative Erickson, you probably have enough time to pose your question. We probably won't have enough time to answer it, but
it's quick.
Yeah, please.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. When you were putting this together, did you have discussions about the inequities of the transportation budgets from, say, metro areas to outstate? I'm thinking in particular of one district where they spend $500,000 out of their general budget to fill the transportation needs, and a similar size district in the metro area banks millions of dollars. And that must lead to what Representative Barrett was talking about with this inequities of funding. I was wondering if you had talked about that or if that was brought up in your discussions. Thank you.
Commissioner.
I'm going to let Dr. Melch answer, but frankly, in our overall discussions, we did not, on the education finance work group, we did not spend a substantial amount of time on transportation per se. And so Dr. Melcher may want to add any information he has on that, but just to be upfront, that was one area we didn't spend a lot of time on. We had a lot of things to discuss, but we didn't get to that one.
I see Mr. Melcher nodding.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erickson, the committee did not spend a lot of time on transportation. We did have some feedback on transportation in some districts, and it seems to be kind of an isolated thing. The state does have a policy. It's called transportation sparsity funding, where we do provide a significant increase in transportation revenue to rural districts, depending on their population density, as opposed to the metropolitan area. So some of these districts are receiving $400, $500, $600 per student, more than districts in the metro area, to cover added transportation costs. So kind of globally, if you look at rural Minnesota versus the urban areas of the state, we're pretty equitable in terms of funding the added transportation costs in different areas. But again, if you look at individual districts, some of them, due to unique circumstances, will have significant unfunded costs. Some districts in the rural area will have significant savings in terms of, we probably need to do more study of that, but I don't think there's a kind of a regional global issue there, metro versus rural. It's more of an individual, unique characteristics of the district and whether our formula is adequately addressing those needs.
Thank you, members. We are, I apologize, Mr. McHenry, we could probably have a further conversation about transportation. We are over time. We will meet on Thursday. Please stay tuned for the agenda, and until then, we stand adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.